topic is going to be discussed with Barry M. Andrews, who's a Thoreau scholar and transcendentalist, and author of Transcendentalism and the Cultivation of the Soul. Many other titles on related topics that he will be... Well, Ron, I realize you're not intending to talk here, but it would be handy if at least you explained... there's a workshop that started, and it's ongoing. Barry is part of that, but what's been going on? What's ongoing?
Well, for the past 4 weeks, we've been doing a reading study group on his book, and it just ended today, we did this in anticipation of him coming to speak tonight at 7 at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and then tomorrow at 10 a.m., he'll be doing a 3-hour workshop at the Unitarian Fellowship. And so we have him for the weekend, and he'll be doing the sermon on Sunday also.
Very well. And the Port Townsend Society of Young, or what is it called again?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is a co-production with the Port Townsend Friends of Jung.
Friends of Jung. Thank you.
And we partnered up with the scholar.
Whatever.
Forgetting. Yeah, another program within the Unitarian Fellowship run by Rod Mitchell. Visiting scholar program. And so we partnered up to bring Barry for the weekend.
Okay, and so he will be here for the weekend. He is here now, too. I'm going to read a bit about you, and then we'll talk about stuff, okay?
Sure.
So American Transcendentalism is often seen as a literary movement, a flowering of works written by New England intellectuals who retreated from society and lived in nature. In Transcendentalism and the Cultivation of the Soul, Dr. Andrews, Barry Andrews, focuses on the neglected aspect of this well-known group, showing how the Americans developed rich spiritual practices to nurture their souls and discover the divine. As a minister for 30 years, Barry Andrews has preached the gospel of transcendentalism in Unitarian Universalist congregations on both coasts and in between. Retired from the ministry, but not from life, thank heavens, he now has leisure to watch the seasons come by, to savor views of the Olympics, and on we go. At least once a year, he makes a pilgrimage to Concord and to Walton Pond, where the seeds of spirituality in America first took root. Walton Pond, and now I'm not reading. Well, looking at my notes, it's your Mecca, right?
Oh,
it's your
well,
Lord's.
Yes, I mean, Walton Pond is a pilgrimage site. Over 1 million people a year visit Walden Pond.
And recall for me the first time you went there and the most recent time you went there.
Well, let's see, the first time would have been in the mid-1980s. There's a Thoreau Society, which is the oldest and largest society dedicated to an American author. They have an annual conference around the date of Thoreau's birth in July each year, and I was able to attend one of those somewhere in the early to mid-80s, and that was the first time that I visited Walton Pond.
And truly, you go every year?
Almost every year. And when we lived on Long Island, I would sometimes go up 2 times a year, sometimes 3.
Do you ever swim in the pond?
No, I think my wife has. But,
really?
But I haven't.
Is that true? Yeah, she has. Indeed, she nods her head.
No, I go out to the site where the cabin stood, and the cairn, a pile of rocks near the cabin. See, after Thoreau left Walden Pond, the cabin was not used anymore. Somebody bought it and turned it into a storage bin for food for livestock, and it just kind of deteriorated from there. And after a while, then people couldn't remember where it was.
Are there any sticks remaining from the original pond? Or not pond, but cabin?
Well, legend has it that there are. There are certainly some bricks, and when an amateur archaeologist finally located the cabin some years ago, he dug up all kinds of nails, including a lot of bent nails, so conjectured that Thoreau might not have been as good a carpenter as he might have been. But by the 1880s, as I said, people were coming to Walden Pond because they discovered Walden, the book, and wanted to pay a visit. Bronson Alcott was still alive then, and he knew Thoreau, and he knew where the cabin was, so he took this woman out there, showed her where it was, and they decided to start a cairn, you know, which is a pile of rocks that would indicate where the cabin had been. People keep bringing things to add to that cairn even today. And when the Berlin Wall came down, I was just surprised to see a piece of the Berlin Wall on that cairn.
So from your website, which is where I got those words I read, and I will read again, you have preached the gospel of transcendentalism. What's the gospel?
I don't want to get into the weeds too quickly here. The gospel is self-culture. That is to say, they called it the art of life, kind of a spiritual practice that they engaged in that involved sauntering in nature, conversations, lively conversations amongst friends, journal writing. They were religiously cosmopolitan, so they shared an interest in Eastern religions, which was new for the time. So these activities were kind of all engaged in raising their consciousness politically and socially, and also enriching themselves and their spiritual lives.
Did they use this term among themselves, transcendentalism?
Transcendentalism?
Yes. Did they?
Well,
did they know they were transcendentalists?
Well, interesting. I mean, I guess none of them knew where that term came from.
Who coined it?
Well,
and when?
They don't know. They
really?
Don't know. Emerson, when they started meeting, I mean, this was a group, an informal group, at first primarily of Unitarian ministers who were dissatisfied with the state of the church and society at the time. So let's get together and discuss the new views that were coming in at that time from Europe and Britain, essentially romantic views. So
romantic poetry.
Right, right. Yes. They were influenced by romantic poetry and romantic philosophy. Emerson was the central figure of the group. He thought they should call it the Symposium, after Plato's Symposium. Others had some other ideas, but at some point it was dubbed the Transcendental Club, which is, you know, little. Well, I guess it was a nod to Immanuel Kant, who wrote about... essentially about epistemology, how we know, his philosophy was termed, a transcendental philosophy. Not that they were strict Kantians by any means. They were more influenced by Coleridge and Wordsworth. But I guess the idea is that we have senses, ways of knowing that transcend the senses, the everyday world. They might have better been called immanentalists, because they felt that that God, as they understood God, was immanent in the world, not apart from it.
So God was important to them. The concept of God was important to them. Did they dwell on that concept?
Well, yes, but the whole, I think the biggest... change they made was in changing the notion of God. Instead of God being a supernatural figure, God was within, within each and every person, and God was immanent in the world. It was kind of a life force within the world. So God was no longer a person, no longer an entity separate from the world, but very much a part of it. That's, it's a very romantic concept as well.
So I was raised Catholic. Needless to say, this is not a Catholic notion that you're presenting here.
Right.
But to the extent that I hang out with anybody in a religious context, it's Quakers, and that sounds very much like the Society of Friends.
Well, yes. Emerson was very enamored of George Fox and the Quakers that he knew. Very, very similar to Quaker belief.
And why is it, I would say, logical or likely that transcendentalism would emerge from Unitarians?
Good question. Well, The Unitarians split from the original Puritan congregations of New England, not so much over, well, Unitarianism means one God, not three. Okay, so they read the Bible for themselves. They used reason. They were in an Enlightenment group. They used reason. They couldn't find any biblical justification for a Trinity. So they said, well, we're Unitarians in that way. But it had more to do with human capability. The Puritans believed in predestination and original sin. You know, God knew from before you were born whether you're going to heaven or hell, and there was nothing you could do about it. Well, the Unitarians, or at least, well, they called themselves liberal Christians at the time, they said, well, no, human beings, by the way they choose to live, can contribute to their salvation, you know, by living virtuous lives. So that was kind of the split there. Now, the Transcendentalists were Unitarians initially, and most of them remained Unitarians, but they were kind of a radical fringe of Unitarianism.
Were they branded heretics?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Were they persecuted?
No, they weren't persecuted, but in 1838, Emerson had, he was in seven generations of Unitarian ministers. Well, not ministers, some of whom the later ones were Unitarian. So it was natural, I guess, that he turned to the ministry himself and served a congregation there in Boston. By all accounts, he was a popular minister, but he broke with that congregation and with Unitarianism over the issue of the Lord's Supper. His brother had trained for the ministry in Germany. He studied under scholars of the Bible who said that there was no justification in the Bible for the continuance of the Lord's Supper. His brother shared that view with Emerson, with Waldo, as he called himself, and so Waldo petitioned his congregation to be released from the obligation to serve it. They turned him down, so he quit the church. But he was well known within Unitarian circles, and in 1838, the graduates of Harvard Divinity School invited him to come and give an address to the graduates. He did that, and it was called, well, it's called today the Divinity School Address, and he's talking about the demise of what he calls historical Christianity. He felt that it could no longer be justified on rational grounds, and that religious belief should not rest on scriptures and church traditions. It should be experienced individually by the individual. It should be an inspiration for the individual rather than relying on scriptures and rituals.
So, do you think a transcendentalist would consider Walden and your book as being equally scriptural as what people term the Bible?
Well, yes, I think, you know, models for literature writing in those days were frequently sermonic models.
That word needs definition.
Or sermons.
Here. Okay.
Sermons, okay. So in a sense, they were writing sermons or scriptures, you know, modern-day sermons or scriptures, based on their own understanding and their own experience. I think a lot of Emerson's essays come across that way. Thoreau's do as well, although Thoreau was never trained in the ministry and never served as a minister. But they took natural images and vested them with biblical qualities. You know, they found sermons in stone, so to speak. Their imagery was often natural imagery, derived from their experience in nature.
And therefore, it's easy to see the connection between Transcendentalism and Wordsworth and
right,
Coleridge.
Exactly.
Did they, I don't know whether Thoreau knew Wordsworth or Coleridge, whether they conversed, whether they wrote to one another. How, you know, one is on one side of the ocean, one is on the other, right?
Well, Emerson had a crisis of faith, as I was indicating. His first wife had died. He had this dispute with his congregation. He decided to leave the congregation in 1833, and he went to Europe. He was there for 9 months, I think, traveling through Italy and up through France and into Britain. Now, he did have these wanted to meet these literary lions like Coleridge and Wordsworth. They were, I guess you'd say, they were elderly at the time.
The Wordsworth of his youth either, was he?
No. No, both Wordsworth and Coleridge had become quite conservative in their views by the time Emerson met them, so he was disappointed in, on that score. But he also looked up another person that he'd heard about, Thomas Carlyle. He was of the same age and also was a romantic. He wasn't a romantic poet, but he was a romantic writer. So he met with Carlyle outside of a little town called Ecclefechan in Scotland. They spent a memorable night together and went for a walk on a mountain nearby and spoke of the immortality of the soul. They were lifelong correspondents after that. Emerson did go back to England in 1847. And met Carlyle again. By that time, Coleridge was dead, but Wordsworth was still alive, so he paid a visit to Wordsworth, too.
Transcendentalism and the cultivation of the soul. Okay, how does one cultivate one's soul in a transcendental manner?
Well, they were great readers. Now, they didn't read so much for entertainment as for insight and inspiration. And they would read classic literatures, Roman and Greek, and also as they became acquainted with them, the scriptures and philosophies of the Eastern countries, particularly India and China.
So these are educated people.
Yeah.
What if one is not an educated person? I mean, what if one's education either stopped at high school or whether it maybe was an engineer's education out of a university?
Well, they believed that self-culture, as they put it, was good for everyone. And William Ellery Channing, who had been a prominent Unitarian minister at the time, he gave a lecture on self-culture to a group of mechanics, workmen. Mm-hmm. And he recognized that that they were spending, you know, way too much time working, but he thought that they could squeeze out some time here and there to cultivate their soul. So I guess it does apply to everybody, and you have to engage in it, deliberately, but you do what you can, and it is something that everyone could benefit from.
So there's reading. What else is there?
Well, there's reading, sauntering in nature.
Sauntering, that's a good word.
Well, yeah.
Really?
I mean, see, today people go for walks, they go for hikes, often for their, you know, exercise and for their health and so on. I mean, they spend a lot of time out walking, hiking in that sense too. But Thoreau spoke of it as sauntering, which was a kind of a meditation for him. Or seeing without looking, you know, taking things in, you know, being aware of what's around you. But as soon as you look at something, you know, then you kind of break the spell that it's a form of contemplation, really, you know.
So did you listen to the music that was on before you? In here, were you able to listen out in the lobby?
No, I didn't hear it.
So I wonder about both the making of music and the experiencing of music.
Uh-huh.
I didn't encounter that in your book. For me, that's very important.
That
helps me transcend
sure.
an awful lot of things.
Well, they certainly appreciated music. I focused on the things that came up most often in their writing. Now, of course, Thoreau played the flute, and he was very good at it. His idea of a wonderful afternoon would be to be in his handmade boat out on Walden Pond, just drifting, while he played the flute and listening for the echo. You know, that certainly nourished his soul. And a lot of the things that he writes are triggered by hearing music. Somebody playing a piano somewhere, or somebody strumming a guitar, and that'll stimulate his imagination. I don't know that that was true of the others. I can assume that they appreciated music, but they didn't write about it. One thing I neglected to do, and I'm a little sorry, is poetry. They all wrote poetry. Now, it doesn't always rise to the level, you know, that that we might call good poetry, but certainly Emerson and Thoreau both published poetry.
So when I think of transcendentalism, I think of either a budding or an actual religion. Mm-hmm. And when I think of religion, I told you I was raised Catholic, I think of an ethical system. Mm-hmm. I don't find that in transcendentalism.
Well, actually, it's a very kind of a moral mysticism. They believe strongly that every person had a moral sentiment, and the idea was to nourish nurture that. They were the most activist of any religious group I'm aware of in their time. They were, Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, you know. It was while he was living at Walden Pond that he spent a night in jail for failure to pay his taxes because he didn't want to support a government that was invading Mexico. They all felt that way, and they were all ardent abolitionists.
And I actually have a hard time reconciling the meditative sense that I get from your book and from what I've known of transcendentalism from my past education, and being politically active, certainly being politically active the way people are today, which is to say very much absolute in their beliefs.
Well, they believed in what they called the higher law, which they felt was ingrained in the Declaration of Independence, but not in the Constitution. You see, the Constitution allowed for slavery. But on the other hand, the Declaration of Independence, in their view, was superior to the Constitution, and that they believed that that there was, well, as Emerson would put it, there is one mind common to all. We all are part of that one mind, you, me, and everybody else, and as such, we all have in inherent worth. That was the, you know, the inner impetus, I guess, for their involvement in so many reforms, educational reforms. They were they championed not only abolition but women's rights, the environment. The whole notion of eco consciousness today derives from Thoreau and his belief in the intrinsic worth of nature. So they not only spurred a lot of reforms in their own day, including educational reforms, but they inspired succeeding generations of Americans to be engaged as they were.
So in reading your book, in thinking about your book, in even talking with you now, I keep bumping into, I guess it's a phrase, and I don't know where I go with it, and I don't know where you're going to go with it, but we will hear. And here it is, transcendentalism in the age of Trump.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Well,
who probably thinks, if he thinks, that he's getting his moral righteousness from himself.
Right, right. Well,
that groan in the corner was Mrs. Barry Andrews, who just actually threw a book at me.
Well, you know,
I
mean, fair to say, they would be aghast and they would be dumbstruck, you know, that the United States would ever elect such a man. But you have to remember, too, that it was during their period that they elected Jackson, you know, who was in favor of the forced removal of Native Americans. In a lot of ways, the economy in those days was a kind of a Wild West. It didn't have a national bank. Jackson ended that. In 1837, there was the severest depression that the country's ever known, you know. 25% of American businesses closed. Unemployment was very high, you know. So they did face some of the same kinds of challenges we do today, and I suspect that if they were alive today, they would respond to them in the way they responded to them in their day. Certainly, the challenge of slavery. I mean, can you imagine? You know, a country having 4 million people enslaved and not knowing.
But only counted as 2/3 of a person each.
Right, right. And so they were really up against huge odds. The South had a stranglehold on Congress because of the...
Kind of still does.
Right, well, yes. and they were beside themselves. How do you do this? How do you end it? So they said, well, send them back to Africa. Well, no, that's not going to work. Buy them out of slavery. How much is that going to cost? Finally, the Civil War, answered that question at great human cost.
And with that, believe it or not, we have to end this conversation.
We were just getting going.
I realized that it was going to be one of those kinds of conversations for sure. And what happens with this show is it gets booked. Well, it just gets booked. It's what happens with it. So what we've done here, I hope, is we have acquainted our listeners with you, because you are going to be, and I don't remember the details, I know you're going to be preaching the sermon at QUUF on Sunday. Mm-hmm. So you have activities today and tomorrow also.
Right.
Can you tell us what those are? And then I have to say goodbye to you.
Well, I'll be giving a reading from my book this evening at the Quimper UU Fellowship. I think that's at 7 o'clock. And then tomorrow, also at the Quimper UU Fellowship, I'll be offering like a 3-hour workshop around the book.
And I'll ask Ron, does one need to make reservations for that, or can one drop in at QUUF at 10 o'clock tomorrow?
They could. It would be preferable that if they come to the lecture tonight to sign up for that, for the workshop the next day. So we get a little bit of a head count that would be helpful.
Okay. Thank you, Ron Strange, for setting this up. Dr. Barry Matthews, I want to talk with you some more. So I think
Barry,
I can...
Barry Andrews.
Who's Matthews? I do not know, but I'm glad you know your name and can correct me.
Well, and thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you for being here. And what's your name again? Mrs.
Linda.
Yeah, Linda, who threw the book at me a moment ago. Luckily, I was able to duck. Next time, I will know that I need to be alert. Thank you, all three of you.
Yes, well, thank you, Phil.
Thanks a lot,
Good to
Joel.
Meet you.
Yeah,
appreciate
time.
It.